Today, it's a pleasure to have Kieran. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Yes, yes. Good enough approximation. Kieran, but Kieran. I respond to many approximations.
Okay, Kieran from sunny Buffalo. Kieran got his PhD from Durham in 2010, I believe.
Yep.
And his postdoc in Fermilab. And then 1 or 2 years in Bohr.
And 1.5.
1.5 in Bohr. And you'll be telling us a lot about precision.
We'll see about the precision of the precision. But well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be in Canada. Every time I'm in Canada and I look at the money, it sees me what British money could be like, and it's it's a real shame for me to not have that at home. But it's very fun to see it here.
We can change the weather for the menu.
So yeah, today I'm going to be talking about precision physics for run two, and I was going to make a slide, but I ran out of time. So I was just going to draw a quick sketch for the first slide. So, of course, we're all hopeful that the LHC will soon discover new physics. But what sort of new physics it discovers is not well defined. We can imagine situation one, where some nice clean resonance is found. And then it's very easy to see that the background is not fitting the data, and that we have some new particle. And of course, the Higgs will be an example of this type of discovery. Or it could be in a much more complicated setting where we have some broad excess from some very wide resonance or some effective field theory spread out over the background in a rather hard to distinguish way. And so I'd like to just spend a couple of minutes discussing why precision is actually necessary in both of these cases. You may think this one it wasn't really necessary, but it's more necessary after the fact. And of course, the canonical example of this is indeed the Higgs discovery. So I'm sure you're all aware that Higgs was discovered a couple of years ago. If not, then you're probably in the wrong room. But it's quite interesting when you look at the Higgs discovery to compare the different media interpretation, in particular from my angle, the North American versus the British media. So so CBS, basically they went in, this was on the July the 4th, the headlines from the papers. So CBS announced very quickly that it was a Higgs boson, you know, for them. That was it. Electric symmetry breaking was sorted out day one. So CBS were very quick naming it as a Higgs boson. The New York Times, you know, their readers are a little bit more artsy, perhaps. They wanted to go for something a little bit more, poetic. So they said that the physicists find elusive particle seen as key to universe, which was very, very arty. And then So we Brits have a bit of a reputation, I'm afraid, as being, you know, emotionally stunted and reserved. And I'm afraid the BBC did not do us any favors internationally with their headline. They basically said the Higgs boson-like particle, so they weren't ready to call it the Higgs boson on day one. And they discovery claimed at the LHC. So maybe, you know, the LHC says their discovery, but we're not going to call it just yet. So that really didn't help matters for us. But yeah. And then, so most people would, you know, stand up here and tell you the Higgs boson was a great discovery and they're very excited and happy, but I'm going to break the mold and I have to tell you that the day the Higgs discovered was one of the saddest and most bitterly regretted days of my life, mostly because of this New York Times article that I just referred to. So they had this little picture on the website and on the, I guess, in the paper too, maybe, and it had a little caption saying, "Scientists at the Fermilab in Batavia on Wednesday watched the presentation about the discovery of the Higgs boson, which was shown from Geneva." So I thought, oh. So the reason why I am bitter and sad old man now is that if you use the wonders of technology, that's me. if this chap here, this elderly gentleman, had been sitting back in his chair, which he should have been, you know, it was 4 in the morning. Some people are very excited about the Higgs discovery. So if he'd have been sitting back in his chair, then I would have been famous, right? That would have been my picture there, face there, right there on the New York Times with the Higgs. So I could have, you know, phoned my mum and said, "Oh, look on the website of the New York Times, there's me." And, you know, that would have been the best day of my life. You know, the Higgs discovered and famous all at the same day. But no, this guy basically ruined my dreams. So I'm over it now, as you can tell. But yeah.
He also has a mom, you
know? Yeah. Well, anyway, he stole my glory. So me and him are now enemies for life. If you know who he is, then let me know. I think he's on CMS. All right, anyway, moving on to physics. So, okay, So now that we know a little bit more about the Higgs, we actually have some more data since the July the 4th announcement, and we can really see that it behaves, as far as we can tell, like a Higgs boson of the standard model. And of course, one of the most compelling plots to confirm this is the plot on the left-hand side, which shows the coupling of the Higgs basically is a function of the mass of the particle it's coupling to. And of course, in the standard model, this goes with this nice linear iteration. And with the data that has been recorded thus far, it seems to fit that pattern nicely. Of course, there's a large errors on the lighter particles and also the coupling to the top. But certainly that plot is compelling that at least the sort of 10-20% accuracy, it's a standard model Higgs boson. But of course, then we look at the plot on the right, and this is really what we want to see. We really want to compare the individual branching ratios for the different channels, because of course, new physics scenarios could change the individual branching ratios in non-trivial ways, such that some go up and some go down, and then we see significant deviations from the standard model. So the title of this section was Why Precision? And we see immediately that, okay, maybe you don't need precision to discover the resonance because it's sticking out like a sore thumb over your data. But certainly now to answer the questions about what type of resonance it may be, and the Higgs is the example here, we really need precision because we want to get this best fit sigma over sigma standard model. We want to get the errors down there as small as possible. And one of the key components of this error is indeed the theoretical precision, which comes from the standard model prediction. So up until recently, this was a next to next leading order calculation, which had a precision of around 10 to 15%, depending on how you define things like PDF uncertainties. So very recently, this is actually one of the most interesting things going forward for run two, is that now the standard model Higgs precision has been dramatically increased. And so this very, very, very interesting and complex result, which was put out just a couple of months or so ago, has actually resulted in the completion of this calculation now at n cubed LO. So this is now getting hard to say, but it's next to leading order in perturbation theory. So it's a three-loop diagram and all the related friends. And so so now what we can see is the sort of money plot is really the bottom one here, is that the theoretical precision is now, which we estimate by varying this parameter on the x-axis, which corresponds to scale uncertainty. So this is in the full perturbative result, this should be a flat line. But as we truncate the perturbation series order by order, we have a dependence on this parameter. And you see at leading order, basically, the result is completely bogus. You can't really use it. If you use the leading order result, you would immediately conclude that the standard model, that the Higgs is not a standard model Higgs and is some weird exotic BSM model where the Higgs is twice as copious. But then we see by increasing the order in perturbation series, we begin to converge. And the nice thing about this n cubed LO result is that we see it lies completely within the perturbative prediction of the next leading order result, and is almost flat. So we are basically approaching the limit where perturbation series is converging down to something which you cannot see the scale dependence anymore. So this now means that things like the inclusive cross section for the Higgs are now very well defined, at least from the theory point of view. So we can begin to upgrade the plots that we saw in the previous slide and really look in the type of interaction for the Higgs to see whether there is indeed any.
So this is the inclusive cross section?
This is the inclusive cross section, yeah. Yeah. So this is not differential yet. But you see immediately there's many things you can do with it. So first of all, it is indeed the inclusive cross section, which is the number that really enters actually this denominator here most of the time. But secondly, you can now actually work out exactly which you have a lot more confidence in choosing a next leading order scale for your differential distributions by making sure that it isn't one of the few regions where there's an outlier. So you can say that now we have the scale choices such that the normalization of our differential cross section at NNLO matches the n cubed LO result. So I have to immediately tip my hat to these guys. It's a very, very complex calculation. The fact that they managed to do it they basically started when the Higgs was discovered, and the fact they managed to get it done in such a short space of time is incredibly impressive. Okay, so then that was motivation number one, which is for the case of when we have a broad resonance which is sticking out over the data, and everyone with eyes can see that it's there. So that was, I hopefully gave you a little bit of an idea of why you might need precision in that case, but that's usually after the fact. That's usually that we want to understand the properties of the new particle and look at it in some detail. So now I'd like to give an example of situation number two, which is probably looking at the results from run one, much more relevant for our discussion going forward. And this is the situation where our signal prediction is very broad and some tail of a standard model distribution. And so a canonical example for this would be the search for dark matter, which is really picking up steam at the LHC if we're going in for run two. So of course, most of you in the audience know much more about this sort of thing than me, but the evidence for dark matter is now completely overwhelming. But this is mostly coming from observations from cosmology, which report on the gravitational interactions of dark matter. So thus far, we've never seen any non-gravitational interaction which would help us pin down a particle theory of dark matter. And this is something which the LHC is, of course, desperately looking for. So it's now so important to the LHC that the big shots of the LHC are really putting their hopes on this for run two. So there was in the excitement with the start of the LHC starting up again, there was interviews with Rolf Hoyer on the Guardian website. He really highlighted this dark matter search as being one of the key flagship searches and ideally measurements of the run two of the LHC program. So of course, you can't believe everything you read on the website, so I have to at least say that this is according to the Guardian. So he probably just said something very, you know, we'll do a neural net search for some this, and then the Guardian interpreted this as whatever they wanted. So anyway, so of course, the problem with making dark matter of the LHC is that you can't actually see it because it comes from decays to things which don't interact very much with matter. That's what we know about dark matter. It certainly doesn't give off much light. So we have to have a recoil object. And this, of course, is the famous monojet analysis. And you can imagine some experimentalist grad student was very excited when they were told they were going to play with monojets. And they saw this on the internet, this surfboard up here, which is some kind of, I don't know what it is, but it's very fancy anyway. I imagine playing on that looks like a lot of fun. But anyway, I'm sure they were thrilled when they realized that it wasn't that. They had to actually then look at this data and search for the missing ET, which comes from the dark matter, and the jet, which of course comes from the initial state radiation. It looks immense. It looks absolutely immense. Basically, I think it's some kind of hoverboard thing, or it looks just very, very dangerous, but also very fun. So, do a monojet analysis at your own risk. All right, that's my message there. Okay, so then this is the plots, which are really a lot more detailed than my sketch over here, but they basically show you the concept. So what we're looking for in this type of analysis is we're looking mostly in the tails of the distribution, and we're looking where there's many different types of background, and they dominate over the signal. So you see that both the CMS and the Atlas plots show this, where the dashed lines come from the BSM signal hypotheses, which they're testing in this analysis. They're doing a few different searches at once, but the dark matter example is the blue line in the CMS plot, and then the orange line, which maybe is impossible to see, is down the bottom. Oh, no. The technology here is so impressive, you can even see yellow on projectors, which is probably the most important, amazing thing so far today. Okay, so you see in these situations that the signal is very, very hard to see. And you can imagine that if I change my prediction on the tail of this distribution, I could easily remove or enhance or change significantly the results of the analysis, and then hence the results on the bounds of the new physics model, which we're desperately trying to constrain or ultimately observe. So the idea of finding some kind of effective field theory result, which is this very smooth sort of enhancement in the tail, where you don't get the propagator suppression from the EFT, is very difficult. And you would have to, of course, know, and there's many challenges, both on the experimental and the theoretical side, but one of them is knowing the shape of this blue curve, which is the Z plus MET backgrounds, as best you can. So in these sorts of situations where we're really looking for very smooth, very broad EFT type results, then it's very clear we need to have advanced theoretical predictions for the shape of the background. Okay, so I'd like to highlight one that I find particularly interesting, and this is looking for BSM effects of the Higgs, where the interaction is coming from some effective field theory type approach. So the idea is that you don't see any new physics directly like this type of particle, and so you would like to now constrain the standard model as an effective field theory, and so you would like to know what sort of scale are my higher dimensional operators at? What is the scale of the physics that that we can't see but we'd like to constrain? So this means that you have to add some higher dimensional operators into the standard model, which then have obviously non-renormalizable and have a mass scale in them. And if you assume baryon and lepton number conservation, then the first one you can add in is the six dimensions. And there's, of course, this now, there's many operators that are gauge invariant and six dimensional. So you can add in a lot of different options. We're sort of, in this talk, we're not really going to go through all the Lagrangians and all the formulation. We're just going to look at a particular target, a particular type of interaction, which is the interaction of the Higgs with vector bosons. So this is one of the, obviously has a lot of electroweak physics going on, and we would like to parameterize it in terms of operators which remove the standard model, which deviate from the standard model physics. So in this vertex on the right-hand side, the first term would correspond to the standard model coupling, and then everything else with these Gs would be a new type of interaction which is not present in the standard model. So the aim of the experimental analyses would be to try to constrain the size of these operators, which then could then be used to infer the scale of the UV physics which is generating the operator. So you would think, well, maybe you would think, but you would probably guess that a good way to look at this would be to then look at the interaction of the Higgs with the vector bosons, because that's what the vertex we just wrote down. So you mean the historical anomalous couplings?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not very different because a lot of the same operators will give rise to the same physics. So
the bosons are a bit easier to probe because you can produce on shell, QQ bar, Z.
Yeah, so there, you're about a slide ahead of me.
Okay,
so.
Sorry.
Yeah, so sorry, that's the problem when you talk to such a good audience. No, that's, so they come from effective field theory. So you have some high energy theory which is renormalizable, but then these states are so heavy that basically the interaction gets integrated out, and as a result you just have an effective operator which couples then more fields to each other, and then that is six or even higher dimensional, and this is non-renormalizable. So it's the standard model is interpreted as an effective field theory which is valid up to the scale at which you would then begin to probe the UV physics. So you would think, and I think your question was basically alluding to this, that this is a good place to look for it, because then you would see you're just making, you can make these four muon pairs or something, and you can look at it very cleanly in the data, and then you can probe and constrain the anomalous couplings. And whilst that's true, you can do that, it's not actually as good as you would hope, because the Higgs is very light and obviously is actually lighter than the vector boson pairs that you're decaying it to. So you have to force one of the vector bosons off shell, and this means then that you never actually get to probe the high energy region, which is exactly what you'd be after, which I think was basically what you're asking, right? So instead, a much more natural channel would be to look at associated production, because then in basically answering your question, you do get access to the high energy S channel behavior, because then you can make this very energetic. And so you probe the effective coupling here, which, because it's non-renormalizable, grows as you increase the center mass energy. So this is actually going forward once this is a more difficult search channel for the experimentalist, because it's obviously a lot messier. And typically, you have larger backgrounds, and you have to you normally decay the Higgs hadronically into BB bar pairs for this. So you have to look for boosted topologies and things. But once you have enough data and you can understand the systematics, then this channel becomes one of the most promising to look for the anomalous couplings. And this is illustrated in this plot, which I borrowed from this paper here, which shows these are just normalized shapes. So it doesn't actually cause any kind of suppression in the low invariant mass region. But in the high invariant mass region, basically it has more events in the tail, which come from these non-renormalizable operators. The shaded is the standard model, sorry. So the shaded is the standard model, which obviously peaks fairly low invariant masses. But then as I add in these non-renormalizable interactions, basically these guys grow. And ultimately, I would break physics. But of course, the PDF suppression helps me keep physics going for a few extra decades. Good. OK, so that's the motivation. And if I wasn't teaching this semester, I would now be able to present this calculation, which we're going to try to do, and next leading order. So we have a very nice, precise standard model prediction down to the 5 percent or so level. which then you can use, because obviously you want these couplings, if they're going to come from sensible physics, should be rather small, because you want to have a perturbative coupling and maybe a large scale. So those two things together let you know that these anomalous interactions are going to be at the percent level or smaller. So you need to have a knowledge of the standard model to a similar scale. So if I hadn't been teaching this semester, and when I agreed to come, I was hoping I would be able to show you these results and give you a nice terminology talk and talk you through that. But sadly, the calculation is not quite yet finished. So instead, I will give you a scope of why it's not finished and discuss the actual various problems that one encounters when doing a next-to-next-neural calculation. Yep. Yeah, I mean, that's also, so the VBF channel would also be a good channel to look at. There you don't get the S channel, right? So it's T channel, but you still can get enhancements in different regions of phase space. You don't require the vector bosons to be off shells, so you can probe them in a T channel, but this one will get the S channel enhancement, which is what you want to look at the high energy behavior. So the vector boson fusion will beat basically, I say beat because you can still do good things like the CP odd ones are still pretty good to look at different angular distributions in the standard four lepton decay. So it's not like it's completely useless to look for these things in the regular decays. But just if you really want to look at high energy, then you have to go for an S-channel process. So. Yep.
So when you look at all the distributions, are there certain things that are robust? Are there certain ratios in the distribution that are actually robust that don't really change when you...
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question. There's two parts to the answer to your question. So the first part is yes. Basically, there are some distributions which are better than others. And as you could imagine, things like this, which is a Lorentz invariant distribution, is much better. Because this is obviously Lorentz invariant observable. So if I have a large, so what you worry about is if I had a large QCD emission from any one of the partons, so from, the BB bar or from the initial state. If I radiate a very hard QCD parton, that dramatically changes the kinematics of the topology. So any event which is sensitive to those kind of boosts is going to be very bad in terms of perturbative expansion. So yes, and there are observables which don't suffer from that, which is exactly any kind of a Lorentz invariant observable which is insensitive to boosts which come from significant emissions from the... They have higher the corrections and invariant mass. But of course, if this thing is decaying to a W, this is WH, then your invariant mass distribution is not going to be very well defined because you have to only look at the transverse plane, so you're back into the topology. So for a ZH search or a ZH search, I'm not sure whether Canadians or the Canadian audience is British or British. No, is anyone actually Canadian? Okay, in that case, I will say Z as I should because it's the proper way of saying it. So anyway. They say Z? No, Canada's a sensible country. Yeah, that makes sense. Good. Happy to be here. Good. Okay, so the Z and the Higgs, because you can maybe observe the actual MVH distribution, is actually less sensitive than, say, than the WH, where you only get the transverse mass projection. So that's answer part one, which is there are some observables which are less sensitive, but the problem is the rate, right? Because that always hits you, right? If you're looking at anything which is just reliant on the fact that this is my cross section, then you can have the shape less sensitive to higher order corrections, but the rate will always be raised or lowered according to the normalization of your total prediction. So you can there's no free lunch, but you can get half of your lunch by just looking at a good observable. And ratios of cross sections are also sometimes less sensitive to that sort of thing too. But then it gets a bit difficult to estimate your uncertainties. And anyway, so good. Okay. All right. Go for it. This is like the fun half of my talk. So let's.
what about in a given distribution, defining certain numbers associated with the distribution that are more robust? For example, the ratio of the peak to the
So you would say, I want to look at the cross section below 500 and above 500,
right,
say.
Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of thing would work fairly well for this type of analysis. You would cancel many of the perturbative uncertainties doing that sort of thing. I don't know whether it's the best experimental analysis, because usually they want to have a control region and then a signal region. So maybe there's a a clash between what the theorists would like and what the experimentalists would like. But normally, you would, as a theorist, you would like to calculate jet cross sections. And then the ratio of, say, WH plus one jet to WH plus zero jet will be different with the anomalous couplings compared to the standard model. And that sort of thing then has a fairly well-defined experimental and theoretical interpretation. So that would be, I mean, that's a good way of looking for it. But that sort of thing is exactly where you want to have the next net zero order prediction so that you can basically expand to the same powers of alpha s, your ratio and your numerator and denominator. Okay, good. All right, so we are now going to go through in detail how you do a hard calculation, and so maybe you can forgive me for not having finished it, and then in 6 months or so I can drive the 2 hours again and come and present the terminology. So good, okay. So I'd like to just briefly sketch how you would do a higher order correction, because maybe not everyone in the room has done one before, so it's I can take the liberty of explaining how you do it. So, okay. So basically there are two parts to a higher order correction at an next leading order, which depend on whether you have the same phase space or an additional part on there. So in terms of pictures, we can think of them as cuts as across an amplitude. So this would be for Higgs decaying to BB bar at next to leading order. These would be the type of diagrams that you get. And this blue dashed line here corresponds to a cut across the phase space. So basically, you're calculating a matrix element squared. This then becomes a virtual piece here, which is a one-loop diagram on the left-hand side times a tree level on the right-hand side. And this one on the right-hand side is called a real, and we see that it's a tree-level diagram with an additional part on, interfering with another tree-level diagram with the same part on. So these are called virtual and real corrections, and of course they are riddled famously with singularities. So the virtual diagrams on the left-hand side have UV singularities, which come from high loop momentum values, so when L goes to infinity. And these can actually be quickly renormalized, so we don't really care about them. Well, we care about them, but we can algorithmically deal with them in a renormalizable theory. And we're doing QCD correction, so we don't worry about the non-renormalizability of the standard model in this approach with the effective field theory. So that's good. So the virtual we can put to bed. And then, we can renormalize it, and then it has some infrared singularities. And then the real over here also has lots of infrared singularities. So what are these infrared singularities? Well, you can imagine that what would happen if one of these gluons goes soft. So what happens is that if one of these gluons goes soft, the momentum goes to zero, and the propagator which it attaches to basically goes on shell. So if the propagator goes on shell, then it basically blows up because you get a 1 over p squared, and p squared goes to zero, so that obviously goes to infinity. So when q goes to zero for a gluon, you get a soft singularity, but not for when a quark goes to zero on the external line. Okay. The problem with soft, which makes it more complicated than just simply taking a factorization, is that the color is still there, right? So this is a colored object. It has a SUN algebra. And the algebra is completely factored from the kinematics. So I can remove a gluon kinematically from the matrix element, but its color flow is still there. So I have to be very worried about the color correlations when I take the soft limit. And you can do that by basically decomposing the amplitude in terms of these iconal factors, which look basically like individual insertions of a propagator which is going on shell. So we basically take any place we could put a gluon, and we insert it with this insertion operator, and we dress it with the color, and then this should then... Sure. So it's
projecting out one, right?
So first of all, it's not that Q should be a G, so let's pretend it was a G. And then this is a matrix element with a vector in the color and spin space with an additional part on, which is then projected out by the right hand state. So that projects out, sorry, I should have made that clear. So the formula there is basically projecting out a single part on from the vector. So it basically removes the spin and the color of one gluon, and you see it really is basically then it's removed it from the vector on the right hand side, but then it's kept it in this current correlator, so it still has all the color and the spin. It's just removed it from the initial vector, and now it's in the information is in this iconal current here. Does that answer your question?
Your bra is on the P.
Yeah, the bra is basically the bra information is really just projecting out into this J.
Okay.
which is the makes it back into the same dimensionality. Okay. Good. So then to of course we're interested in the matrix element squared. So we have to take the adjoint of this current and the gluon propagator, which is now basically up to gauge terms the g mu nu. And that then gives us the factorization of the whole matrix element in the soft limit, where again this q should be the q is fine. This is just my confusing notation. The q is the momentum of the gluon, which I don't know why I did that notation, but I apologize for it. Q is the momentum of the gluon which goes soft, yeah. So I should have said, yeah. Not Q for quark, which is, I should have called it different. K would have been a much better name. But anyway, so now this current correlator and the gluon propagator together then give you the factorization of the whole matrix element squared, which is ultimately what we want. Now it's decomposed in terms of these products of iconals and the matrix element with the one less part on. And this matrix element one less part on has a color correlation operator inserted in there. So this is a color, it's a leading order matrix element, but it has a color information projected onto it, which comes from the next leading order amplitude. So the soft is a lot more confusing than the collinear, which is what we're...
If you try to draw it, for example, in 2-2, so you have 2-3 and you move 2-2, do those things have some easy visual...
Yeah, so you see, you just sum over all the massless partons. So it's basically anywhere, if you have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, say, and say they're all quarks, then basically you can make an iconal current where you attach a gluon here, and then you have a, so this is, say, would be a, this one here, and this one is the spectator, so this is basically what's conserving the color. So this would be, like an S14 in this language. And then you can also put one here, where 2 is the observer. And so then that gives you an S12 correlator. And then you can also have an S13, because you basically go over all the permutations where one of them is the emitter and the other one is basically there to conserve the color charge. So yeah, you can basically take your massless partons and just imagine inserting a soft gluon on each of them, and then taking another one of the massless partons, which gives you the spectator, which is conserving the color. So you just have to sum over I and J, whether they're all the massless partons in the amplitude. Okay. Good. So that's actually the most complicated singularity that you get, because it has all this color information, which is a little bit abstract to think of when we like to think of kinematics. The other one is much more kinematically, so at least for simple people like me, I always find kinematics easier to understand than the SUN gauge algebra. So this one is basically the limits in which two massless partons become collinear, which means they travel in the same direction. And in this instance, basically the angle between the emitted gluon and the spectator quark will go to zero. And this is, of course, now a nice kinematic singularity. So all you have to do is define your momentum such in terms of some reference vector, which defines the direction in which they approach each other in the phase space, and then basically take the momentum of this, the momentum squared of this reference vector to zero, and that then defines your collinear limit. So this is a nice one because you don't have to worry about color, you only have to worry about spin. And now spin is basically the role of color because you have to conserve the spin in the factorized matrix element. So then in this factorization approach, what happens is that the matrix element now with two partons, A1 and A2, which go collinear to form a new parton, which is A, has some spin-correlated matrix element, which are defined by T, which is basically just the matrix element for the leading order process interfered with another when you don't sum over the spin of the particle which is going collinear. So this is a spin-correlated matrix element. And then you insert, so you contract that with an Altarelli-Parisi splitting kernel, which then gives you the spin correlations in terms of the reference momentum. So it's simpler than the soft because you only have to worry about the kinematics, and the factorization is actually much simpler once you've calculated, of course, this g mu nu term just gives you exactly the leading order matrix element, and then this term gives you a new matrix element, which is not that bad to calculate. It's just a leading order matrix element. Good. All right, so that's the simple one, right? That's the next leading order, which is bread and butter. You can basically do that for any process the LHC now. So next leading order, it's a lot more complicated because we have more terms. So so here now, instead of having just one additional parton, so here in next leading order, we can only radiate one more parton and get our right powers of alpha s. Now we can radiate up to two. So if we begin by looking at this M phase space, which is the the leading order phase space, then what happens is you can have a two-loop calculation where you have a two-loop diagram here still interfering with the leading order. And this was called the double virtual. And basically, a friend of that, which is sort of intimately related, is the square of the one-loop amplitude, where you have a one-loop amplitude on each side. And you see that both of these live in the same phase space as the leading order, and that we integrate over the BB bar pair at the end.
Shouldn't it be called the squared single virtual?
I think let's just call it the one-loop squared. But the double virtual is really referring to the phase space, right? So the BB just means that you have no additional particles in the. So you have two virtual processes. Whether the one-loop squared double virtual is a technically good name is up for debate. Okay, so then you can also imagine cutting that topology different ways. So you could now cut across the phase space, so you have an additional parton in the final state, and still a loop process on the other side. So this now becomes a one-loop process with one additional parton, and this then is a tree-level matrix element with additional parton too. So both of these on the left and right-hand side, they both live in a m plus one dimensional phase space. So we have to integrate over this guy's additional momentum. And then finally, you won't be surprised that we could also have a cut where we now have two particles in the final state, which are emitted. So we have here a leading order matrix element with two particles, and on the left-hand side, the same thing. So this is called the real-real. And this one is actually where the next neural frontier is wide open. So for many processes, this is the hardest part because you have to integrate over a lot of infrared singularities. Whereas for many processes, this is the most complicated part. Whereas for other processes, the two-loop diagrams are the bottleneck. So really, there's a lot of open problems at next leading order. All right. So briefly, I'll just go through the additional problems you get. We're next leading order, but they all boil down to the fact that now instead of losing just one parton, I can lose two. So now instead of just one of my gluons going soft, I am in the situation where both can go soft, and I still have to keep all the color correlations so that I don't accidentally violate color. But we can basically look at a simple example, which we'll focus on for the rest of the talk, which is when we look at the Higgs decaying to four quarks. And we treat the BB bar as massless apart from the Yukawa coupling. So we treat these all as massless partons. And the red line here is basically some quarks, which is not a B line. So this is a UU bar or a DD bar. So now the soft limit is when Q1 plus Q2 is zero, and this gluon is soft. And that's basically obtained with Q1 and Q2 both going to zero. But the ratio of Q1 to Q2 basically remains fixed. So now, in the same sort of fashion as we had before, we're going to have some leading order matrix element, which is, say, for us, just the Higgs decaying to BB bar, then some kind of insertion operator, which basically describes the physics in the soft limit, and this then will give us the factorization of the matrix element in that limit. So this we can basically build from the iconal currents in the same way that we did before. So we have our J's, which are the J mu's, and which are basically the iconal currents from the gluon. And then in here, we have basically the quark loop contribution to the discontinuity of the gluon propagator, which just looks something like this. So it's not actually too bad to work out what happens, because we have to take our previous iconal current, the J mu and the J nu, and just contract it through with this discontinuity of the gluon propagator. And that then gives us the insertion operator, which now a lot more complicated than the next leading order case, but it's basically the same sort of thing. We have a color-correlated matrix element, which I should have left the labels on there and this on the right-hand side, and then some factorization in terms of an iconal current, which is now more complicated because it's next leading order. Ah, very good. Definitely in Canada. All right. So this is just I thought it was questions. Okay. That's good. I'm glad you said that. That could have been messy. All right, good. Okay, good. All right, now it's all cleared up. All right, so now, imagine the case now where I have three of my partons, and all three of them go collinear. So now basically the angle between all three of them goes to zero, and all three massless partons travel in the same direction. And this is again basically analogous to the next leading order result. is just going to be more complicated in that I have a spin correlated matrix element, which is basically the leftover spin of this initial line here. And then my splitting function, which describes the physics in the limit where all of these guys go collinear. So that's basically now what we have. We have this matrix element, which has all these singularities. And we know the form of these singularities by just evaluating the matrix element in those limits. So we know that we have soft and collinear singularities, and we actually know what the matrix element looks like in those individual limits. So it should seem fairly textbook to put it all together and finish the calculation, right? Because we know what the matrix element looks like, and we would like to basically then write a Monte Carlo code, which we can run, which is obviously finite. So we would like to have something which removes those singularities. So it doesn't seem that hard, because all you would have to do is take your matrix element and then define some subtraction term, which is basically the matrix element in the individual limit. Take that away from the matrix element, and then everybody's finite, and then you're happy because you can integrate up the phase space and, using your Monte Carlo code. So that seems a rather straightforward way of doing it, and that's exactly what we would do at next leading order. We would just define some local term which cancels all the singularities. Then we take that local term that we subtracted, and we do the integration analytically. Then when we have the integration analytically, we can add that back to the virtual piece, which itself has a 1 over epsilon pole or 1 over epsilon squared pole, which come from the soft and the collinear. And then by the magic of the KLN theorem, they cancel. And I have a finite result, which I can then compare to data. So that's basically the way that you would think is the best way of going forward. But the problem at next and next leading order are many. So one of the main problems is basically how you deal with these multiple singular regions. Because I said, OK, there's this collinear limit here, and there's this soft limit here, and I know what happens here. But the problem is that I can have a collinear point which then goes soft. So I have overlapping singularities. And it's not clear immediately how my subtraction terms are going to cancel them individually and not accidentally double count. And then maybe I have infinities put back in, which is very bad. And then there's the task of actually integrating these subtractions analytically to produce your counter terms, which cancel the virtual poles. And that is very, very difficult. Certainly not impossible, but very, very challenging. And so far, so this isn't impossible at all. It's just a very long and hard project. And the Zurich and Durham groups have basically made a method that works that is called antenna subtraction. And this is this basically does this approach where it makes a counter term that cancels the singularity, and then you integrate it. It's a very long, and I think it's, if you're not a member of the collaboration, it's almost impossible task to code it up. So they have it pretty much working. There's a small semi-important, semi-unimportant issue to do with angular correlations that I mentioned in the collinear limit, which may make some differential distributions impossible with the method. But if you have an XNet in order code that makes 99% of distributions, you're happy. So this was basically one of the most successful methods going forward. But then in 2010, the field had a bit of a kick when Mikhail Shakom proposed a new subtraction method, which is not analytic but numerical. And this has then actually led to many developments in the field. So there's been recent calculations of Higgs plus Jet and Z plus Jet by groups out of Argonne and Chicago. And then, yes,
you can.
I can. I put my name on it. Yes, because the KLN theorem basically still holds, right? So you can do so, and in particular, you can often do the calculation not differentially but inclusively, and just check the KLN theorem at the beginning of your calculation. So this factorization is basically proven to work at least at order alpha S for all of these pieces. So at next and next leading order, I can definitely happily answer your question. Yes. Okay. Good. Okay. So now, in the remaining 10 minutes, I will briefly show you this, and then at the end, you can understand why the calculation, the terminology, isn't there. But I can show you at least a part of the calculation completed, and then, you see physicist toilet humor knows no bounds. This was not my name. This was not my name. I can only apologize for my colleagues. It stands for sector improved. Real radiation something. But yeah, you see that they had the name before they thought of the, yeah, so, yeah. It's what it's called. If it offends any of the members of the audience, I suggest you write to this gentleman here. He's an Aachen, and that's not, you know, not me. I didn't invent the name. But yeah, so anyway. So this is how you, this is, okay, so the idea is that now, so that the previous approaches that worked at NLO always relied on these analytic integrations, but now the idea is to actually move all of the singularities from the matrix element into the phase space. And then if you can do that, then you have maybe a numerical method rather than an analytic one. So the aim is to write a fully differentiable Monte Carlo code, which can basically generate these four partons, and it can integrate these, it can only require the existence of these two particles in the final state, so it can integrate these two particles out if necessary. So you can have maybe, you can have two, three, or four jets in the final state, but the question is then up to the clustering and not up to any kind of cuts in the matrix element. Okay, so the first trick, which is actually nice and simple, is that you can write one in a rather interesting way. So you can use partial fractioning to write one in terms of these two individual ratios, and then use this basically to decompose the phase space into two different sectors. And this doesn't look like much, but it's actually quite magic, because this piece here, this first piece, is damped by this SQ12 factor, where this is the invariant mass of the propagator. So if SQ12 goes to zero, then this acts as a damping factor, which actually removes many of the singularities from the matrix element in this sector. Of course, they're still there because they're now just over here. But this one over here is actually removing its friend, which comes from the emission from the other leg. So basically, it separates, by doing that, you initially separate the singularities, at least at the triple collinear level, into two regions. So you say either these two partons here are near this one, or they're near this one, but they're not, but I won't have a situation in one sector where they're basically at both, right? So this allows me to divide the phase space very quickly into two sectors in which I only have to worry about one triple collinear splitting in each one. So I've basically halved my work from the get-go, and that's a sentence I love to hear. So now the idea is to basically split this phase space into two. So this is just the leading order phase space. We're not particularly interested in this. This is now the phase space that we care about, which is the phase space for the massless partons, which we're going to integrate out. So we basically make a reduced phase space, which is a production of this state Q, which looks like a leading order Higgs production, but now, of course, the Higgs has mass Q squared and not MH squared, and then we're really interested in this D sing, so we'll ignore everything else for the rest of the talk. So the trick is now to actually just parameterize your momentum in a very simple way. So it's basically just very simple kinematics. The idea is that now your P1, we're going to use Lorentz invariants of the phase space to define a frame in which the quark, the B quark, is always moving in the x direction, and then we can basically define the P1 to always move in the xz plane, and then after that, basically, this is then defined by momentum conservation to have this form. So I've suppressed, this is actually in d dimensions, so this is now x, y, and z, or x, y, and z, and then there's also a zero, which just corresponds to all the d-dimensional components that we're not going to worry about for now. So what's nice about this is that we can now introduce these two parameters, eta 1 and eta 2, which correspond to these difference of these angles. And now, if eta 1 and eta 2 go to zero, then this corresponds to the limit where cos theta is basically 1, which basically means that theta is zero and the particles are collinear. So we see that already by just writing it in this format, this z1 here and z2 correspond to the soft limits when they go to zero, because then the whole p vanishes. And these eta 1 and eta 2 are the collinear limits. So we already have four variables which have all the singularities sitting at zero, so they're nice parameters for the phase space. So the only one we're missing is the angle between 1 and 2, which can itself go collinear and be a double collinear singularity. So this is a bit of a car crash when it comes to being simple to talk to me about in a talk. But the idea is that you just define a new variable called x5, which then, by defining x5, gives you the difference in terms of this formula down here. And when eta 3 goes to 0, q1 and q2 are collinear with each other. So this means that that now we have all our limits defined very simply. So this slide is much more easier to understand. We basically have five parameters, which now completely define the singular phase space. If these parameters here, z's go to 1, then the particle I is soft. If eta I goes to 0, sorry, if this goes to 0, not 1, then they're soft. If they go to, if this eta goes to 0, then they're collinear. And if eta 1 is equal to eta 2, then the particles 1 and 2 are collinear, and that's it. So now we have all of the collinear singularities parameterized, and all the soft singularities parameterized. We just need to know the ordering of them so we can do the integrations in a coherent manner. So I'll skip this slide. It's really only there for completeness, which basically shows you how you would now parameterize the phase space in terms of these new integration variables. So now the trick to remove all of the separate singularities is just to repeatedly split the phase space up using divisions of unity. And then in each new sector, you just rescale the parameters such that you have a new integration variable. And then this new integration variable should go between 0 and 1 with your singularity sitting at 0. So it's easiest to just to break the chain through. So we start off with our complete phase space in one of our sectors, in one of our triple collinear sectors. And we say, OK, is particle 2 softer than particle 1? And if it is, we go into this half. And if it isn't, we go into this other half, which is symmetric. So we'll just ignore it from now on. Then you say, OK, so you notice I've not thrown any events away. I've just split them into two piles. Then you go into this this level down here, and you say, OK, is particle 1 have more collinear than particle 2? Or is particle 2 more collinear than particle 1? And if they are, I rescale the variables now, such that basically eta 2 is always less than eta 1, because this is a number between 0 and 1, and that's eta 2, and vice versa over here. And then I'm now into now four sectors in total. And then finally, I have to parameterize the remaining collinear singularities, which occur when the eta 1 equals eta 2. So I have to say, okay, is eta 2 greater than a half, or is eta 2 less than a half? And then this sector down here will basically contain the point where eta 1 is equal to eta 2, and this one will never happen. So then I now have a breakdown now in terms of these new variables, which are basically here in this table, which now correspond to very isolated singularities, where I know in each sector what limits are allowed and which limits are not allowed, so that I don't have to worry about double counting, and all my singularities are well separated. So that's a reasonable mouthful, so I can just show you what happens in each sector. So if I let x1 go to 0, then what that means is that z1 and z2 are both 0, which means that the particles are both soft. So every sector has this because this is always a kinematic splitting. So every sector will always have a double soft singularity, but that double soft singularity is exactly mapped to the 0 of my integration variable in x1. So I know that there's no other double soft limits which come from x2, x3, or x4, or x5. Then x2 for us is actually a non-singular variable, because if x2 was 0, then only particle 2 is soft. And if we were doing BB bar plus 2 gluons, this would be a singular region. But for us, it's not, so we can ignore that one. That's just a finite variable we're integrating over. Then the x3 goes to 0 is when both eta 1 and both eta 2 go to 0. So both of the emitted quarks are collinear to the B quark. And this is a triple collinear splitting. So now we have that one sorted out. And finally, x4 goes to 0 is the double collinear, which only lives in these two here. And you can see that by the fact that if I set x4 to 0 here and here, then I get x3. So eta 1 is equal to eta 2. Good. All right. So now we're nearly there, don't worry. So now all we have to do is to write our phase space in a good way. So we do our Jacobian transformations from our old variables to our new variables. And looking at explicitly at sector S4, which has everything, we see it has this sort of form, where we basically have these integration measures with some x1 plus 1 plus n to the epsilon, and then some regulating factor here. So we basically write our we write now our phase space coupled to the matrix element, which is our ultimate target, as this thing here, where f is now the product of these phase space separate variables here times the matrix element. And this thing is, by construction, finite for all values of x1, x2, x3, x4. So it's basically non-singular in any of the xi go to 0 limits. And all of the singularities are now mapped to this measure here in the phase space. So all of the singularities have been removed from the matrix element and put back into the phase space. And you may think, oh, great, so what? I've still got the singularities. But the joy is that we can use a Laurent expansion to actually perform the series in Epsilon under our phase-based integration and now rewrite our phase-based integration as an analytic series in Epsilon, well, at least a semi-analytic series in Epsilon because we're going to do the integrations numerically, plus a whole bunch of plus distributions, which are themselves finite because you basically take away the singularity at zero by construction with the plus distribution. So by using this Laurent expansion technique, we can now basically rewrite our whole sector as a series of integrals over these functions f, which are completely finite in any limit. So for example, if you take the x1 goes to zero limit, then what you get is the matrix element for the leading order process times the iconal factor that we saw for the two quarks, times this regulating function, which cancels the singularities, and then I can set x1 and x4 to zero, and then I get the formula that's like this. So you see this is a nice little polynomial, and it's easy enough to type into a Monte Carlo code and get it to integrate it up to give you your singularities. So a nice little simple example is the leading pole, which is the most soft and collinear pole, which comes from 1 over epsilon to the cube term, and that basically comes when I set everything that isn't x2 to zero, and then I can just do the integration analytically, and I get this term here, which is exactly what I need to cancel the poles in the virtual and the real, and you just have to believe me. Okay, so then the final slide is now to test the whole thing. So we integrate up all the sectors, we add them all together, and we get this number here, which is the top line, and this is a numerical number, so it's come straight from the Monte Carlo code. And then we can actually do the calculation inclusively using reverse unitarity techniques, which is a separate talk in itself. This is how the Higgs calculation was done at the very, very beginning. And here you can then see actual analytic results. So this is just obviously fractions that have been truncated. And you see that they agree that the numerical precision is such that basically the errors are exactly as you would expect to make these numbers the same thing. So you see that basically to good numerical precision, it works. So that's the punchline. And so the joy of it, you may say, okay, well, that's great. You spent us a long time boring us, telling us how to generate this number here when I could just send the analytic calculation and get the same number just to infinite precision rather than numerical precision. But the point is that this one is just an inclusive cross-section. I can't use it for anything more than a total rate, whereas this one, once I generate an x1, an x2, an x3, an x4, and an x5, gives me a complete phase space. So I can use this one here to make differential distributions and histograms, and this one here I can only use to compare the total rate. So it's a much, much more powerful technique, albeit that it's now obviously limited at some point by numerical accuracy. So, good. So the conclusions. So basically today I've sketched out how you do the worst parts of an X and X in order calculation. And as I said, these techniques that were pioneered by Chacon have really led to a revolution in the field now. Basically, we're doing these types of calculations that before we never would have thought possible. Did I? What? Did I? What have I spelled here, sorry? No, that's right, isn't it? Two P's.
The first time you had
the S-T-I-R. Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm a very innocent man. I don't know.
It's
yeah, oh, yeah. No. No, that's what I was telling you. I was telling you. They have absolute toilet humor, I have to say. It's I can only apologize to my colleagues. Yeah, so there we go. There we go. Yeah, not me. I'm just forced to present it. They gave it the name, you know. I was trying, you know. So anyway, no typos. Okay. It is indeed stripper. And yes. So the stripper routine is basically led to the calculations of things that we never thought we could do up to a few years ago, like the TT bar, next and next thing on a cross-section, the Higgs plus jet cross-section, the Z plus jet cross-section. And now we can actually use it for fun projects too, like for looking for things like these anomalous interactions with the Higgs. And hopefully, I mean, the calculation, as I've shown you, is I have all these individual parts. It's just a matter of putting it together into the Monte Carlo code. So I'm hoping that it will come out at some point over the summer, but who knows. And then, of course, I'd be more than happy to come back and show you the terminology. If you'll have me, I won't say any more rude words. And that will hopefully come over the next few months. So thank you very much for your time. Any other questions before I close down the laptop?
Mm-hmm. For example, in the example of for the coupling of the Higgs to the vector boson,
yeah.
The work that you did, what accuracy does it give you if you combine it? for the GHWW, the parameters you have there.
So this will be next to the next neuron in QCD,
yeah,
and then leading order in the electroweak physics.
Ah,
so
see.
So you have, you ba- I mean, QCD is the one you want to pin down because that's your production mechanism,
yeah,
and that's the one where the backgrounds are dominated.
Yeah,
definitely, yeah. But even in the ratios,
yeah,
you still want to expand them to the highest perturbable. And in fact, if you do the next to next neuron ratio,
yeah,
then it's well defined if you do the zero jet. So if you do a ratio of 0 to 1 jet cross sections,
mm-hmm,
and you expand to the same parameter in alpha S,
yeah,
then it's, you have to define the zero jet cross section to next to leading order, and the one jet cross section to next to leading order. And then you have both numerator and denominator expanded to alpha S squared. So the idea is that, yes, it helps in both because then it gives you a better denominator. But yeah, the ratio method is actually one of the best ways of looking for these types of anomalous interactions because you cancel many of the experimental systematics as well as then having a reasonably well-defined theoretical prediction.
Okay, no more questions.
Thanks.